Okay, well, we are here with Dr. Trevor Downing, who is with us from Asheville Radiology. He's one of the interventional radiologists here to talk with us today about the management of uterine fibroids, specifically minimally invasive treatment options for these patients. And Dr. Downing, I just wondered if you wouldn't mind to just introduce yourself briefly.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for allowing me to speak today, and I really appreciate the opportunity. I was at Wake Forest for a number of years prior to coming here to Mission in Asheville. I've been here for about a year, but have been in interventional radiology as a practicing physician at Wake Forest for about 5 years. So
wonderful. Well, welcome to Asheville, yeah. And we're very glad to have you.
Thank you.
So if we could just start by talking about what are uterine fibroids? How common are they? And start with that.
Yeah, absolutely. So as many of you might already know, uterine fibroids are the most common benign neoplasm of the female pelvis. So we know that in their lifetime, up to 80% of African-American women and nearly 70% of Caucasian women will have fibroids. Now, not all of them will necessarily develop symptoms, but a fairly common disease process.
And is there a particular age at which these might arise most commonly?
Not necessarily. I think you typically tend to see them in patients who are over the age of 40, but we've certainly seen patients younger than that with uterine fibroids. Those tend to be the African-American women that have them earlier, but I'm not suggesting that there's statistics related to that. Typically, it's patients who are over 40.
Okay. And what would be the presenting scenario?
So typically, only about 50% of women who have fibroids will present with symptoms. A lot of patients, I think, go with them unrecognized. And the most common symptoms that patients will present with is menorrhagia, basically, right? So excessive periods. They're soaking through numerous pads or tampons a day. They're having to get up at night to change pads or tampons, bleeding longer for than a week, passing large clots, that sort of thing. So the most common presentation is menorrhagia, but there's also a lot of patients that will present with bulk symptoms, right? So just this feeling of fullness of the uterus, and the uterus obviously can push onto the adjacent structures, so you can have bowel and bladder dysfunction, so urinary urgency or frequency. Constipation is one of the things that patients will often complain of. And then just the idea of abdominal protrusion, right? They just feel that the uterus is boggy. It just feels like their uterus is enlarged, almost like their early pregnancy.
A good review of systems on an annual physical might raise something that somebody might not complain about because they've been living about it for quite a while. Is that typical?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right. I think if you were to ask the questions, I think you'd find a lot of women would divulge these symptoms. But many, I think, probably just deal with them. They say, oh, my periods have always been like that. Mm. You know, if they're really bad, obviously, patients will present with anemia. And those patients obviously will complain about it sort of as the chief complaint. But you're absolutely right. An annual physical, patients will oftentimes divulge some of these symptoms.
Great. Well, that's very helpful. So what would be the array of treatment options for these patients?
So interestingly enough, there are a lot of treatment options, and not all of them are necessarily surgical or interventional. So, you know, a lot of patients will do just fine with, you know, birth control or Depo-Provera shots, or even IUDs can help to control the symptoms of uterine fibroids. You could technically give patients GnRH agonists like Lupron or Cinerelle or something like that, but we'll talk a little about those later. Those obviously carry quite a bit of side effects, and so that's not oftentimes one of the first treatment options. And then after the medical management options, really do get into surgical and interventional options. So the patients can have a hysterectomy, right? So that can be any array of laparoscopic versus open or robotic. They can have a myomectomy, which is really just resection of the fibroid itself, not taking the whole uterus. And then you have the interventional radiology option, which is uterine artery embolization, also sometimes called uterine fibroid embolization. Some people call it a UFE for short. But uterine artery embolization is what we offer in interventional radiology. And then finally, there's actually something called HIFU, which is high intensity focused ultrasound, which a lot of people do not know about, which is where you lie on an MRI scanner and they actually put an ultrasound on that fires, you know, high strength ultrasound beam into the fibroid to to dissolve it. I will say that that's very rare to find that available, because you have to lie on an MRI scanner for about 6 hours to have that one done. So not a lot of patients get that done, and it's not offered in a lot of places.
Is that something that you might offer as well?
We do not offer that at ARA, and I'll be honest, most academic places don't even offer that. And the main reason for that is that MRI scanners are typically very expensive, and to have it occupied for 6 hours to do that procedure typically is not financially viable, basically. I mean, you can run 6 or 8 MRIs in that time frame. So no, we don't offer that at ARA. And truthfully, it's really not that common of an option. It just is one of the options for fibroids.
Okay. So it sounds like most primary care physicians might be familiar with the medical management. So if your patient fails medical management, what would be the next consideration for treatment?
Yeah, so I think a lot of this should be done in combination with primary care, gynecology, and IR. I don't think, you know, sending them straight to IR will necessarily give you the best results. I think, you know, gynecology plays a significant role in where these patients can ultimately end up with their treatment options. But I think any patient that fails medical management or they just sort of get tired of the idea of still having prolonged periods or bulk symptoms not controlled by the birth control can seek additional treatment options. And so we are happy and in IR to see any patient in our clinic. We have a clinic once a week. There's 7 providers, and we all see patients in clinic once a week. We're happy to see any patient regarding uterine artery embolization. But if they're not necessarily a candidate, we'll send them on to gynecology, or we'll refer them back to their gynecologist if they don't seem like they're a good candidate. Truthfully, nearly anyone who can get a hysterectomy or a myomectomy is also a candidate for uterine artery embolization.
I see. So it sounds like it has to do with the vasculature, specifically about the candidacy for uterine artery embolization.
It's a little bit less about the vasculature, because I think the patients that have uterine artery embolization, or at least fibroids, typically are between the age of 40 and 55 or 60, and they don't typically have issues with, you know, atherosclerosis that results in narrowing of their arteries that may be difficult to get into the arteries. The most common reason we wouldn't do uterine artery embolization is if the patient desires future fertility, and we can actually talk about that more in a little bit. But the bottom line is there's some early concerns about patients who desired, you know, additional fertility, you know, down the road, but didn't want to deal with the fibroids. And so there was a concern that uterine artery embolization would, you know, make them infertile, basically, which is not actually the truth that studies have shown. Mm. So those are the most common patients that may not be candidates for uterine artery embolization. But there are other patients that, for instance, their fibroid is either hanging into the endometrial canal on a thin stalk, what we call pedunculated fibroids. And those fibroids are at slightly more risk to slough or to be have expulsion, and that can cause some issues down the road. You know, when we first started doing uterine artery embolization, there was this idea that, oh, the fibroid's too big for uterine artery embolization, right? But in reality, the more and more we've done this over the last 30 years, there really aren't a whole lot of fibroids that aren't amenable to uterine artery embolization. And even those pedunculated fibroids now, many of the studies are showing that the risk of sloughing or expulsion is actually very low. But I think initially when we were doing it, we had some concerns about that. So, you know, it's just evaluating the patient and seeing if it's something they want, as well as whether they're a good candidate for it. But the majority of patients that can get a hysterectomy or a myomectomy are a candidate for a uterine artery embolization, which cannot be said the other way around, right? So if they have a lot of comorbidities, right, they're obese, or they have, you know, COPD or whatever it is that makes them a non-surgical candidate, uterine artery embolization is an excellent option for them.
Yeah, it seems that most, you know, so many women who are, you know, elderly have had, you know, hysterectomies, and they don't even remember why. So this is giving women today another option.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is sort of what the issue is, in my opinion, is that hysterectomy is by far and away the most common treatment option for fibroids. I mean, mm-hmm. if you look at it, the statistics in 2006 show that almost 500,000 women had a hysterectomy, and many of them were not given the education as to the other options, right? Now, granted, not all those hysterectomies were for fibroids, only about a third of those, but that's still a lot of hysterectomies when you look at, you know, the equivalent with prostatectomies or patients who underwent appendectomy. I mean, those numbers for hysterectomy are substantially higher. So yes, I think it definitely gives patients another option, right? I don't think everyone is going to elect for uterine artery embolization, but I think a lot of patients, if they knew about it, would probably give it a shot.
Right. And, you know, hysterectomy has a lot of, I mean, it's a much bigger deal. And I'm sure the long-term side effects are significant as compared to uterine artery embolization.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, I think hysterectomy has come a long way. It's not, you know, what it was 40 years ago. But I do think the main issue with hysterectomy is that it's still a surgery, right? There's still morbidity that's associated with that, right? So, you know, looking at long-term studies for hysterectomy, there's increased risk of fractures, pelvic floor dysfunction, there's cardiovascular risk and mortality. Now, some of those risks are related to the fact that, you know, the ovaries are removed at the same time, right? So laparotomy is done at the same time. And so those are what may be increasing the risk. But regardless, I mean, I think a hysterectomy is still a big surgery and you can have some fairly morbid outcomes with hysterectomy. The other benefit, gotcha, I think, of uterine artery embolization is that if it doesn't work, which is rare, but if it doesn't work, you always have the option to go to hysterectomy, right? Where the same can't be said the other way around, right? Once the uterus is gone, it's gone. And so this is almost, could be used as almost like a staging process, right? You try the uterine artery embolization, it works great. Well, then they're done. If not, they can go on to hysterectomy. And I think that's really a big deal, right? It gives you the options to do it in a staged way almost.
And you mentioned myomectomy as well as a common thing that gynecologists might be able to offer. Is that something that you are in conversation with the gynecologists and the patients about?
Yeah, I mean, I think myomectomy has given patients an additional choice there, right? So if they want to retain the uterus and the fibroid is amenable to a myomectomy, I think it's a great option. And it's still recommended as the primary choice for patients who want to retain fertility. Okay. The idea with myomectomy is you're just really plucking out the fibroid, right? So whether it's, if you go hysteroscopically, right, transvaginally to get the fibroid out, any fibroid that's hanging into the endometrium that's less than 50% of the myometrium, they can basically pluck out. And similarly, if it's on the serosal side, you can do it laparoscopically and pull that the fibroid out that way. And the benefit of that is obviously not quite as morbid as a hysterectomy, and patients can retain fertility. But not all patients who have fibroids are candidates for myomectomy, right? If the fibroid is large and within the myometrium entirely, you can't really cut that out. You really have to take the whole uterus. So,
okay.
And at the end of the day, I mean, look, hysterectomy is the definitive treatment, but you know, a lot of fibroids will regress once patients get to menopause. And so we're really just trying to get them as a temporizing measure almost to menopause, because fibroids naturally will regress once they get to menopause.
Right. So I'd like to learn a little bit more about uterine fibroid embolization. Would you tell us what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way we do a uterine fibroid embolization or a uterine artery embolization is we bring the patient into IR at the hospital, typically. A lot of patients will do this at outpatient facilities, but here at Mission, we take them to the hospital. We place an IV. We give them conscious sedation for the procedure. It's not a general anesthetic. It's conscious sedation. And most patients are actually awake during the procedure. What we do is we put a small catheter in the common femoral artery, or some providers go through the radial artery, and we can talk a little bit about why with the difference. But typically, we go through the common femoral artery, and then under X-rays, we guide the catheter into the uterine artery on both sides, and we inject particles. Those particles block the blood flow, and essentially cut the blood flow off to the uterus. It's an ischemic event, basically. And typically, fibroids, like any tumor, are hypervascular, right? They take blood flow preferentially to the main organ. So that fibroid almost sucks up the particles. So what you inevitably end up seeing is you're killing the fibroids, but not the uterus itself. And so it can be fairly aggressive by cutting the blood flow off to the uterus. And then afterwards, patients typically will stay in the hospital overnight in observation status, but some places around the country discharge them the same day. And the main reason for that is really just pain control.
Is there any contrast use in this procedure?
Yeah, absolutely. Contrast is used in the procedure. It's not a lot. Typically, I'll use less than about 70 cc's of contrast. So, you know, a fairly small amount. If you think about how much you get for a CT scan, that's usually about 200 cc's of contrast. So it's a lot less than that. And we can get away with even less if there's issues of, you know, renal dysfunction. But typically, 70 cc's is not going to cause too much of a problem.
Okay. What does it look like in terms of recovery over the next few days, and what sort of follow-up could the patient expect?
Yeah, absolutely. So the recovery time, as I mentioned, most of the patients, it's an outpatient procedure, or they spend one night in observation status. And then Technically, patients can return to work within 48 hours, but it all depends on each individual patient's pain levels, right? So that's the main thing that we see with the uterine artery embolization is pain. Now, patients will develop some fatigue as well, but the main thing is pain. So if they feel okay within a day or two, they can go back to work. From a technical perspective, right, from a puncture site, that site is healed within 4 hours. So they could technically go back and do whatever they wanted within a day, but it's usually pain or fatigue that limits them. So usually we tell patients, you know, when you feel up to go back to work, typically about 2 to 3 days.
And wouldn't that be sort of like the typical pain of like a bruise, or is what level of pain are we talking about, and what sort of pain management would patients be typically getting over the next days and maybe week or so?
So the main barrier I've felt to uterine artery embolization over the last 30 years is the pain related to the procedure. It is quite painful. Now, obviously, I've never had one, but most patients will endorse quite a bit of pain. The procedure itself is actually not painful at all. 70% of patients had experienced no pain with the procedure. But immediately following the procedure, you've created ischemia in the uterus.
Right.
And so that's a typical ischemic type pain, which is very, very intense cramping. It's almost like basically going into labor. That's very intense pain, that cramping of the uterus. And so, you know, there's a whole host of things that we do to minimize that pain. Now, the pain does change after about 8 hours. The pain switches to more of an inflammatory type pain. Patients start to develop, you know, fatigue, as well as almost feeling like they have the flu, feeling run down, low grade fevers. That's what we call post-embolization syndrome. But the pain is, it's significant. So that's really the main barrier to it. But I think most patients do really well if you do a good job of controlling the pain. So our particular regimen for that pain control is, I will give, you know, IV dexamethasone about an hour prior to the uterine artery embolization. I do something called a superior hypogastric nerve block at the same time as the procedure. What that is you take a small needle and you put it down onto the L5 S1 vertebral body under x-ray, and you inject bupivacaine. And that gives you basically a numbing of the uterus for about 6 to 8 hours. So it really negates that whole first 6 to 8 hours of ischemia. Okay. And then I will put in intra-arterial lidocaine after the procedure. That helps to also decrease the amount of narcotics that patients use. And then immediately following the procedure, the patient will get TID Toradol, as well as we'll put them on a PCA. The problem I've found with a PCA is that patients become very nauseated with it, so they don't want to use it. And so they just sort of tough out the pain, which is not great. So I think all these other anti-inflammatories are really important in controlling the pain. So what I'll typically do once I discharge them is make sure they take up to a week of ibuprofen TID, as well as we'll send them home with a script of Percocet. I'll be honest, once patients make it through the first 24 hours, they usually don't come back with pain or have concerns of pain. That other pain is doable, but it's the first 6 to 12 hours of ischemia that's uncomfortable. So, you know, it just varies on where you get it done. The one reason why some people are moving to more of a radial approach for the procedure is when you do a common femoral artery approach, the patient has to lie flat for, you know, 2 to 4 hours. Well, think about if most women who are in labor were told to lie flat on their back. I mean, it's miserable, right? So most women who are in labor want to walk around. That helps a lot. So when you go transradial, you just put a little band over the wrist. The patient can walk around right after the procedure. So it's becoming a much more common approach is to go transradial to do these. But common femoral artery approach is still quite common. And that's really just from a pain control perspective.
Okay. And yeah. I imagine, I mean, certainly hysterectomy, you know, might have some similar, not the same, obviously the uterus isn't there to have that labor cramping, but similar, you know, recovery time and need for, or perhaps is the recovery time longer with hysterectomy typically?
Yeah, so I've always found that as a bit of a conundrum in IR is that some of the procedures that we do have some side effects, right? So pain or whatever it is. And we compare it to, when you compare it to surgery, it's nothing compared, but we sort of focus on this idea that this pain is so bad. I mean, hysterectomy is no small thing to undergo, right? So those patients are still going to be in pain and be in the hospital for quite a few days after that. And so the recovery from hysterectomy, obviously you'd have to talk closer to a gynecologist about this, but it is longer than that of uterine artery embolization. And, you know, costs as a result are typically much higher because most of the costs, that the differing costs of the two procedures are really related to in-hospital stay. As well as work absence. So it does take a lot longer to recover from a hysterectomy for sure. The risk of infection as well for urinary embolization is exceedingly rare. I mean, I tell patients less than 1%. If it's less than 0.1%, I'd be surprised. You know what I mean? It's very, very rare. I mean, the puncture in the common femoral artery is tiny. It's hardly bigger than an IV, truthfully.
Gotcha. Well, that sounds like a good comparison there, the risk for infection, certainly, and the time in the hospital
right.
exposed to, you know, everything that we do there.
Well, and bleeding too. I mean, occasionally we'll be called in IR to embolize the uterine arteries after hysterectomy because there's been significant post-procedural bleeding, and it fixes the problem. And so we're sort of fixing the problem and treating the problem at the same time here. So, you know, some places will actually do these prior to hysterectomy. So if it's a really big fibroid, they'll actually go to uterine artery embolization before the hysterectomy. They'll embolize it so that when they go in the OR, there's hardly any blood loss. And so, I mean, there's substantial benefit to the procedure, regardless of which way you look at it.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about the target population? Are there any contraindications or specific populations that wouldn't be eligible?
Yes, I mean, basically any patient that has a hysterectomy or a myomectomy is a candidate for uterine artery embolization. Now, some are better candidates than others, right? So as you mentioned, depending on what the fibroid looks like, they may be a better candidate for a myomectomy, right? If it's this pedunculated fibroid and, you know, hanging into the uterus, very easily can be plucked out. That may not be someone that gets a uterine artery embolization. They could, but meaning they're still a candidate for it, but it may not be the best option for them. As I kind of mentioned, the main thing that's always sort of been the barrier to urinary artery embolization is fertility, right? So patients come in, they want to continue to have the ability to have children, but they don't want to deal with the fibroids and the associated symptoms. And so most of those patients are still recommended to undergo a myomectomy frontline. But if they're not a candidate for a myomectomy, they should still undergo a uterine artery embolization because, you know, interestingly, most of the patients we would get referrals from when I was at Wake Forest is actually from a maternal fetal medicine specialist who had significant issues with patients who were infertile because of the fibroids. And so then we would embolize the uterus and they would become able to have children. And so, you know, although there's the stigma of, oh, you shouldn't do it if you want to retain your fertility, it's actually not really a problem anymore. After numerous trials have basically shown that you can still get pregnant after uterine artery embolization. So on a comparison trial, they basically showed that, you know, conception ability was about 62% after uterine artery embolization, and it's between 40 and 60% with myomectomy. So they're equivocal, basically. Gotcha. And so essentially, that's the main thing we'll ask. Now, if patients have really tortuous anatomy or something like that, that may be someone we have the discussion with. But truthfully, we deal with that all the time. So it's really not a contraindication. So the true contraindications to the procedure are active pregnancy. Obviously, you don't want to do a uterine artery embolization or viable pregnancy. And then any uterine infection, right? So if they have PID, we probably shouldn't be doing that until that's been cleared up. And then any suspected uterine adnexal or cervical malignancy. So if you're not sure it's a fibroid, you shouldn't be embolizing it because essentially it just creates this scenario where you assume it's a fibroid and then 6 months later they've got metastatic disease or whatever it is.
Gotcha. So it sounds like, again, you're probably in pretty good conversation with gynecology and or primary care as you move forward with these patients and take their histories.
Yeah, look, I think, as I mentioned with the malignancy, you know, I think one of the primary concerns when people do a uterine artery embolization is, could this tumor be leiomyosarcoma, right? Rather than a leiomyoma, a fibroid, could it be a leiomyosarcoma? But interestingly, leiomyosarcomas are exceedingly rare. And it's actually quite difficult to tell the difference on an MRI between a leiomyosarcoma and a leiomyoma or a fibroid. And so typically we just sort of assume that it's a fibroid. There's a couple things that will show up on an MRI, like if the fibroid's grown a lot in 6 months, like doubled in size, and that's usually a leiomyosarcoma. But even then, it's only about 2.5%. So some states will actually require that we biopsy the uterus prior to doing uterine artery embolization, but North Carolina is not one of those, right? So the insurance approval is contingent upon biopsy, but not in North Carolina. But I offer that to patients at the same time. I say, well, look, if you want a biopsy at the same time, I'm happy to do it. And then we embolize. And if it turns out to be a leiomyosarcoma, they can still go ahead and do the hysterectomy.
Right.
But truthfully, I've never seen it. Not that it wouldn't happen, but it's very rare. So, yeah, we coordinate with gynecology. But as I mentioned, there are very few contraindications to a uterine artery embolization. Almost anyone can get it.
Okay. So say I'd like to send a patient to you. How should I, how, what should I do prior to that? Is there anything that I should try or treat or any information that you want as you get this referral?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I mean, we're happy to see anyone in clinic. I mean, if you have any even inkling of a thought of doing uterine audiolization or even having just the information on it, we're happy to see the patient in clinic. I would say that most patients who have mild symptoms, you could try the oral contraceptives first, IUDs, that sort of thing, and see if it helps. But truthfully, most patients I feel like who will endorse the symptoms really want something done about it. And so at that point, we're happy to see them in clinic. Usually, in terms of imaging, we will get an MRI prior to the clinic visit, or at least, once they get into clinic, we'll get an MRI. And the idea there is we just want to make sure that we can get an idea of whether they're a good candidate for UAE. 99% of those patients are, but we've got to look for things like, is there supply to the uterus from the ovarian arteries, right? Because ovarian arteries can supply some of these fibroids, and the patients that have failure of uterine audiolization are typically when you don't recognize that the ovarian arteries are supplying the fibroids as well. So we're looking for that. We're looking for what the fibroid looks like. If it looks like it's easily taken care of with a myomectomy, we'll refer them on to gynecology. If it looks like there's a high likelihood that they'll slough the fibroid, then we'll refer them on to gynecology. And if they want fertility, we'll have that discussion with them and say, look, it's about equivalent. But the American College of Gynecology guidelines still say myomectomy is first choice there. So we'll refer some of those patients on as well. And then, we just look for things like how old is the patient? The distance to menopause is actually a big deal because if they're 30 and they're getting it's a potential that they'll regrow or develop new fibroids before, they get to menopause. About 14% of uterine autoembolizations have to be redone within 5 years. So it's not a lot, but it's typically those patients that are far away from menopause that have time, 20 years, in order to get to menopause. And those patients will typically require additional treatments, but not all of them. And then we're also looking at, well, what are the symptoms, right? If they have menorrhagia, we know that uterine audioembolization is greater than 90% successful in treating abnormal uterine bleeding. If they have bulk symptoms, on the other hand, it's almost as good. It's in the 85 to 90% range, still very good. And so we're just trying to get an idea, well, what exactly are their symptoms and how likely is uterine audioembolization to help them? And then the MRI will also point out something called adenomyosis, right? So some patients don't have fibroids, but they have adenomyosis, which is essentially endometrial tissue within the myometrium. And initially when uterine autoembolization was done, we didn't do it for adenomyosis because we were concerned it wouldn't work. But now there's numerous studies that have shown that even for adenomyosis, it's about 70% successful in reducing abnormal uterine bleeding. So we look for that just so we can tell patients, but usually it's not a contraindication.
So you mentioned certainly risks, complications related to pain. Can you tell us a little bit more about any other particular things that we should be concerned for?
Concerned about, yeah. So, there's a whole host of complications of the procedure. Most of them are less than 1% of the time. And so we tell patients about them, but they're pretty rare to happen. One thing that is worthwhile knowing is that some patients will develop permanent amenorrhea after the uterine artery embolization. So it's much more common in patients that are near menopause, right? So it's about up to 40% of patients who are older than 45 years old will develop permanent amenorrhea. Truthfully, most women who are getting this don't care so much about that. But at the same time, it is something that patients should be aware of. There's a small chance that patients can develop prolonged vaginal discharge up to a year after the embolization. That's about 1 in 10 patients will develop that. And then there's these whole host of very, very rare incidents of, patients can get sepsis, with the procedure if a fibroid sloughs but isn't expelled. So there's that option or that complication. And then there's very small chance of what we call non-target embolization, right? So when we inject the particles, if they go somewhere else where they shouldn't intend to be going, right, to the bladder or to the rectum, they can develop ischemia of those organs. Those are exceedingly rare in the sense of like they're published once every few years in the literature as that's having happened. So they do happen, but it's very rare. The main thing that patients should be aware about as well is this idea of the fibroid expulsion. Patients will present with pain, fever, recurrent bleeding, or discharge. And that can be up to 3 months after the fibroid embolization. And once again, it's not common, but it does happen with the more pedunculated type of fibroids. It's typically treated, if the fibroid is breaking up and they're passing large portions of it, then it's treated with antibiotics, if they have a fever as well as a concern for infection. And about 1% of patients will require a hysterectomy because of the fibroid expulsion, or it's trapped within the uterus. So not common, but does happen. It's something we look out for. In IR,
just sort of a DNC.
Yeah, exactly. So either they get a hysteroscopic extraction, a DNC, or they get a hysterectomy, depending on exactly what's going on. So most are managed in a fairly minimally invasive way, antibiotics or DNC type treatment. That's really the main thing. So what we'll do in IR is we'll actually follow these patients longitudinally. So we'll see them in clinic at 3 months after the uterine artery embolization. Well, we call them at 2 weeks afterwards. Our PA gives them a call just to make sure everything's okay and they feel all right. But then at 3 months, we'll see them again in clinic. And then at 6 months, I will get another MRI. And the reason for the additional MRI is to document that, one, they haven't had a soft fibroid, and also to document the degree of fibroid reduction in size, so that we can say, yes, you've had, 50% reduction in the fibroid size. Now, if the patient's completely asymptomatic and they're very happy, we won't necessarily follow up with an MRI, but just depending on that interaction, we may order another MRI. And then after 6 months, if they're doing well, we sort of sign them back off to their primary care provider with the idea that any concerns or questions, they're happy to come back. We're happy to see them back in clinic.
Just to go back to the permanent amenorrhea and the mm-hmm. concern for infertility, can you specify, do you have any particular data about, women, in that fertility age range, if the risk for amenorrhea there as compared to other ranges of women?
Yeah, so women younger than 45 years old, the incidence of permanent amenorrhea is between 0 to 3%. Mm-hmm. So not very common, but it is something that's happened. Truthfully, it's fairly rare to have a patient in their early 30s want this procedure done. Mm-hmm. It's usually patients that are closer to 40, they've had kids, and they're having this problem with menorrhagia. But yeah, the younger they are, it's much less likely. There was some initial thought that the reason patients experienced that is because they had some ischemic event to the ovaries, like when you're embolizing, some of that blood flow is getting to the ovaries. Yeah. But there's been numerous studies that have shown you can actually embolize the ovaries, and that's not what causes the amenorrhea. So we don't really know what's causing it. But it is more common as you get closer to menopause, probably hormonal related, and we don't necessarily know what's causing that.
Sure. And then
fertility issue mentioned again, like I mentioned, there's not a ton of studies that have been done on that, but we definitely know that you can absolutely become pregnant after uterine artery embolization. And it's fairly good for those who were actively trying to conceive. It was 60% in one of the biggest prospective studies, which is equivalent to myomectomy. Now, if you get a hysterectomy, clearly you can't have future fertility. Right. And so it's really comparing myomectomy to uterine artery embolization in terms of fertility. But there are those patients, as I mentioned, they have fibroids that are myometrial based, they're not a good myomectomy candidate, and they can't get pregnant because of the presence of fibroids. And uterine artery embolization has actually helped get them to conceive. So right. it actually even has a role in increasing
fertility treatment. Right.
Right. It's just one of those things that we do have to we feel in IR that we should stick with the ACOG guidelines. And mm-hmm. if they're a good candidate for myomectomy, they should get a myomectomy.
Gotcha. And you mentioned, cost difference. Do you have any figures on recent cost differences or anything regionally that would pertain to our patients?
Yeah. So, I think it's always an important thing to know, right? Is this substantially more expensive than hysterectomy? What it turns out is there's something called the EMMY trial, E-M-M-Y trial. You can look it up on Google. And basically what it did was it compared 80 patients who went to uterine artery embolization versus 80 that went to hysterectomy. And it turns out, not surprisingly, that uterine artery embolization was significantly cheaper than hysterectomy. We're talking about $6,000 less. So mm-hmm. the average cost for hysterectomy in this particular study was about 18,000, and for uterine artery embolization it was 11,000. And most of that relates to the work absence costs, right? So patients can go back to work much quicker than they with a uterine artery embolization than they can a hysterectomy. There were some in-hospital cost savings, right? So the patient stayed longer in the hospital. It was about $8,000 for a hysterectomy, the in-hospital costs, versus about $6,000-$7,000 for uterine artery embolization. But once again, that's variable, right? I know a fair amount of guys who actually send the patient home the same day. And that cost is obviously substantially less. But I will say the main concern that we've had with uterine artery embolization when we first started doing it was, If you send the patient home the same day and you don't do a good job of controlling their pain, the first thing they'll do is they'll go back to the emergency department. And because the ED physicians don't typically know about uterine artery embolization, they'll call the gynecologist about those complications. And nobody wants to manage somebody else's complications, right? No one wants to be woken up in the middle of the night to say, hey, this uterine artery embolization is back. What do we do, right? So that was one of the barriers that we had to overcome in IR, is this idea of either don't discharge them the same day, or if you do, make sure their pain's controlled and contact us, right, rather than the gynecologist. Because I think that creates a referral issue, is that if I've got to manage somebody else's complications, clearly I'm not going to want to send those patients on for that procedure, which is understandable.
And it helps that you outlined, you know, your typical treatment strategy, which would include NSAIDs and sometimes, you know, potent steroids, you know, as an option if by, you know, say this was done on a Thursday and somebody comes walking into an urgent care situation on a Saturday.
Exactly.
Something that could be tried. Okay.
Right. I mean, truthfully, the likelihood of them having complications that are recognizable within 2 days is very rare. Most of the time, if they come to an ED in urgent care or even their primary care doc 2 days later, it's expected post-embolization syndrome. They feel run down. They got a low-grade fever. It doesn't mean they have an infection. They can have up to a 101 temp. And as long as it's one time, like we've had patients have 101, 102 temps and it just goes away. And so the problem is they go to the ED, they typically get a CT scan. Well, you've made the uterus ischemic and there's all this particle in there and it looks like an infection.
Right.
So then they get this huge workup that really is unnecessary if you just kind of had the idea of how to manage that. And truthfully, 90% of pain control with fibroid embolization is going to be anti-inflammatory. So however you like to manage that, whether it's naproxen, whether it's steroids, all of that will help. But if you follow the guidelines, or at least all the regimen that I've sort of outlined, it's pretty rare for patients to have a lot of pain with this. It's just if you get behind, a lot of people will do the procedure and then they're trying to catch up on the pain. You've got to get it started ahead of time.
Gotcha.
So,
well, this is very informative. I've honestly not heard of this too much, you know, before recently. And I know that uterine fibroids are a huge issue for many women. So this is wonderful to hear that you do this and what it looks like here at Mission. And I hope many of our primary care providers will feel similarly. So thank you so much.
Yeah. One of the biggest issues with uterine fibroid embolization is provider education, just knowing about it and getting the word out that that is an option. Doesn't mean everyone should get it, but it's just having an option. And patients too. I mean, if patients knew about it, I think a lot would choose it. They just don't get given the option because the provider doesn't necessarily know about it. But if, you know, if there's ever a question or you think a patient might be a candidate, please feel free to contact me. I can provide my cell phone number. I'm not concerned about that. So my cell phone number is area code 937-554-3014. And happy to take texts or calls about it at any time. And then if they want to call our offices, it's 828-213-1395 or 828-213-X-ray. So that would be 9729. 828-213-X-ray, 9729. So yeah,
very
those are
clever.
Some options. Yeah, we try.
Well, thank you so much again, and really appreciate your expertise on this issue.
Sure, and I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.